Chapter 26. How to deal with sadness. 26, 27, and 28. I.e. chapters 26, 27, 28. The following six ideas are introduced, explained in this chapter. 1. Be happy. 2. Sadness is un-Jewish. 3. How to be happy in the face of physical suffering. 4. Where guilt comes from. 5. Beating bad guilt. 6. Remorse needs a dedicated time. 1. Be happy. The Yetzer Hara versus Yetzer Tov boxing match. Just like in a wrestling or a boxing match, a person who is lazy or feeling sluggish will lose to the more alert, energetic person, even if the other person is weaker than them, so too in the battle against the Yetzer Hara. Being alert, which comes from being happy, is fundamental to being able to conquer the Yetzer Hara. I think that must have been written a bit wrong. Just like in a wrestling or a boxing match, a person who is lazy or feeling sluggish will lose to the more alert, energetic person, even if the other person is weaker than them. No, that's correct. So in other words, by being happy, you have the greater advantage than any other situation because it's the energy from joy that gives you the ability to fight. It is impossible to beat the battle with the Yetzer Hara if a person is feeling lazy and sluggish, which stems from sadness and a feeling of dullness, heaviness in the heart. A person can only beat the Yetzer Hara if they are feeling alert, which comes from joy and an open, i.e. happy heart, and a heart which is free from all worries or sadness, whatever the cause may be. Sadness is un-Jewish, the joy factor. As for the verse that there's a benefit in sadness, this does not mean that sadness is a benefit, but that there is a benefit to sadness. And it works like this. If a person is arrogant, they cannot be happy, for then their heart is alone and they are not unified with God. However, if a person breaks their arrogance through telling themselves that they are bad and arrogant, then after they have become depressed and sad, they should remind themselves that God loves them and thereby bring joy to themselves. Now that they broke the klippas within themselves, they can truly be joyous, for previously the klippas were dividing and separating them from God. This current joy is thus the benefit of the sadness. In other words, the benefit is not in the sadness, but in the subsequent joy that follows the sadness. This is why the Holy Ari taught that after a time of sadness, such as in a sad part of prayer, one should infuse oneself with joy. For A, the joy following the sadness allows one to serve God joyfully, and B, in fact, it is a far greater level of joy than normal joy. This is similar to the homily by the wisest of all men, King Solomon, who said, "I've seen that light is better than darkness." Now, this observation is pretty obvious, but what King Solomon is really teaching is that it is only the man who has been subjected to darkness who can truly appreciate and thus rejoices in light. Similarly, the joy that comes after sadness is a far greater form of joy, and perhaps a more permanent one as well. The Holy Ari explains that the emphasis of the verse that tells the Jewish people to be happy Jews, to serve God joyfully, is not on the service of God, but on the joy that accompanies the service to God. This underscores a central tenet of Hasidic philosophy. The main point the author is bringing forth currently, that joy must be a constant presence in the Jew's life, and this is a fundamental principle in the life of a Jew. This is in contradistinction to other Jewish philosophies that often use fear of damnation as a means of trying to bring man closer to God. How to be happy in the face of physical suffering, a hidden good. How can man be constantly happy, particularly in the face of physical hardship, such as financial pressure or a sick child, chas v'shalom, or even one's own ailing health or physical pain? Firstly, I must write, this is the translator writing, that much of what ails us today is not as bad as the ailments of yesteryear. Financial pressures of today are largely self-imposed. There's no need for BMWs taking out second mortgage to make the kitchen more modern. Furthermore, many of the diseases that would cause endless grief to people and to parents have been eradicated or are easily preventable. In the olden days, children would often never die young, and even if one is ill, God forbid, or in pain, many modern medicines and painkillers have helped ease the suffering. This is not to say that there is no genuine suffering. Illnesses such as cancer still ravage human bodies. Often there is financial pressure just to keep the basics of lifestyles going, with sometimes both husband and wife working hard, and sometimes, God forbid, a child is genuinely ill in a life-threatening situation. So we will speak about these genuine problems later. For now, I want to focus on the saying of our sages, that who is rich? Someone who is happy with what they have. I was very impressed watching a program regarding a British lady who married a poor black man from Zanzibar. Their lifestyle is pretty much third world. Tiny house, no running water, bread, just the basic staple, etc. However, she correctly said that there are problems everywhere. So while often the water and the power don't work, nevertheless, there are other problems elsewhere, such as crime, congestion, loneliness, which is not a problem in her part of Zanzibar. Here is a woman who, instead of feeling sorry for herself, was happy with the good that she had in her life. Let us compare her with the daughter of a billionaire banker who went on a summer trip with my cousin, a rabbi from a South American country. This girl went with her friends to the largest toy store in the U.S. All the children were having a grand old time buying the latest and coolest toys. Well, this girl was sad and sat alone in a little aisle. My cousin asked her, "What is the problem? I have all these toys already," she said. So the child, not being able to appreciate the gift of what she had, could only feel sad. So before we speak about how to be happy in the face of genuine problems, we need to speak about how to be happy in the face of genuine blessings. Why is it that one person is happy with a little and another is sad with everything? The classic story is of Jacob and Esau, who met both being exceptionally wealthy. When Jacob offered a large gift to his brother Esau, his brother said, "You keep it, for I have a lot." Jacob said, "No, you take it, for I have everything." The fundamental difference between these two approaches is gratitude. Jacob was grateful for what he had. Thus he felt he had everything he needed. For this reason, he could also share what he had with others. On the other hand, Esau, who was being magnanimous, believed that he could always have more, which is why he said, "I have a lot, but there's never really enough." I recall reading an interview with Ted Turner, who was complaining that he couldn't buy things with his money. For after $200 million, which could buy 5 houses and an airplane, what else is there to buy? He has the Esau problem. Now, getting back to the author's advice. When there is a genuine shortage of money or illness, God forbid, a person should remember that everything that God does, which is everything, God does for the best. However, there are two worlds in heaven. From these worlds emanate all that happens below. In fact, the sages teach that a button doesn't fall off one's shirt without it being preordained in heaven. So every joy and every stress is directly given from heaven for a reason. We should not think that stress is a punishment. Rather, it comes from another world in heaven, which is the spiritual reward side. For every stress in this world, a person who accepts it joyfully as a gift from God will receive untold fortunes in the next world. This is very much like a bank account, where one worked exceptionally hard to put money into the account. However, as the money is there, it begins to accrue interest, and slowly but surely, with time, the person becomes fabulously wealthy. The verse says that for those who accept difficulties with joy, God loves them like the strength of the sun. What does this mean? We know that when Mashiach comes, God will unleash the full power of the sun. We are currently protected from its full power by a covering over the sun. This full strength will be the reward for people who accept suffering joyfully, knowing that everything that God does is for the best. In a Kabbalistic sense, everything comes from heaven, but there is the hidden heaven and the revealed heaven. The hidden heaven is represented by God's first two letters of the name Yud Kei Vav Kei. The final two letters represent the revealed heaven. The hidden heaven is where the source for everything spiritually good comes, which often does include suffering, darkness in this world, for sunlight in the next. Perhaps this is why before people die, there's often a period of suffering, in order for them to enter heaven with zero interruptions. And conversely, sometimes the wicked are paid off in full measure in this world. They have no share in the next world. This is what King Solomon said, "I have seen a reward which is a punishment." Sort of like someone getting a large severance pay after being fired, as the money was only in order to fire, get rid of the person. However, that which is revealed goodness comes from the revealed heaven, the last two letters of God's name. Translator, I recall my father writing to me during a difficult period that I went through that from heaven there comes kindness and strictness. One should never expect only kindness. Again, strictness is not a punishment. Rather, it is a hidden good. To expect only kindness would be like a student only expecting their teacher to do exactly what they want, which would lead to the student never learning anything at all. Incidentally, this is also the nature of our prayers. We're not asking God to take away the benefit of the suffering. Rather, that he should show us revealed kindness instead. The story is told of the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Tzemach Tzedek, who once showed a great deal of affection to a very simple man. His son, later to become the fourth Lubavitcher Rebbe, tried to find out if there was anything special about this man. All his inquiries led nowhere. So finally, he asked his father, the Rebbe, why he showed such special attention to this simple person. The Rebbe replied that this man has a very, very hard life, yet he never complains. And regarding such a man, it states that God loves them like the strength of the sun. So although the average person saw a simple man, the Rebbe saw the greatest man of all, for his acceptance of everything that God does is one of the greatest levels of holiness achievable, as it shows an absolute trust in God. One who has complete trust in God, like a child who had complete faith in their parents, lovingly accepts any rebuke without the slightest hint of resentment or anger, knowing that everything the parent does for them is only for his own benefit. From everything that I have studied, I have concluded that life on earth is about trusting that God knows what he is doing. This is like pilots who, upon entering training school, are told to trust the odometer. The pilot feels that he is going up and the odometer says that he is going down. He must learn to ignore his own instincts and emotions in favor of the message from the odometer. This trust will save the pilot's life every time. Similarly, one must learn to trust that only God's way will bring man happiness, and everything that God does is part of his way. Furthermore, the Baal Shem Tov teaches that when we see the good and the bad, God changes bad to good. Where guilt comes from: conquering sadness emanating from worrying about one's spiritual state and recognizing the Yetzer Hara's tactics. When someone is doing something good, immediately the Yetzer Hara tries to change the subject. A person should know, and if while they are doing good, they are feeling sadness over their spiritual state, i.e. guilty over sins, this is simply a ploy by the Yetzer Hara to bring them down and eventually cause them to sin. The proof of this is if this was emanating from the Yetzer Tov, it would certainly not be happening while someone is in the midst of doing a good thing. Translator, I have to say, in my own life, the Yetzer Hara works on overdrive whenever I'm involved in something good. While I'm eating, preparing for bed, I do not feel that what I'm doing is wrong. However, as soon as I start doing a good thing, the Yetzer Hara immediately tries to show me how I'm wrong in this or in some other thing, which effectively is meant to divert my attention away from doing the good thing I am doing. It has taken me years to become accustomed to the Yetzer Hara's behavior taunts, which now allows me to usually just ignore it. For I know that he is simply a troublemaker that needs to be ignored in order for me to carry on doing a good thing. Even if someone is in the middle of their work day and suddenly they feel sad about their spiritual state, if their work is a positive thing, such as providing for their family, etc., then this too is part of the Yetzer Hara's tactics. He is trying to make the individual sad and depressed and eventually get the person to sin. In fact, the Baal Shem Tov teaches that more than the Yetzer Hara wants man to sin, the Yetzer Hara wants man to feel guilty and thus sad and depressed over their sins. Beating bad guilt: how to respond to the thoughts of sadness over one's spiritual state. Whether this thought of sadness regarding one's spiritual state occurs to the person during Torah study or prayer, or even during their workday, one should tell themselves that this is not the time to be sad. This applies even to severe sins that a person may have done. The Yetzer Hara is trying to get them to think about them. One should say that now is not the time to think about it. In this way, the person can be happy and thus have the energy and alertness to fight off the Yetzer Hara in all other spheres. Remorse needs a dedicated time, the appropriate time to feel remorseful over one's sins. In truth, one needs to make appropriate times to contemplate deeply about one's sins and realize that one has sinned against the great King of Kings, God. One needs to reflect upon who God is, for only in this way will one truly feel remorseful over their sin. One doesn't usually feel great remorse over squashing an insect. However, by knowing God's infinite greatness, one will feel remorse for the pain caused to God by their sin. Perhaps this is similar to a child who understands his parents' greatness and therefore feels more remorse over the pain they caused their parent than a normal child that doesn't care much about it. The time for this contemplation the author describes elsewhere. Furthermore, after one has felt sadness, one can truly feel joyful, as we learned previously, that one needs to contemplate that God in his great mercy has forgiven me. And like we said, the joy after sadness is like the greatness of light after darkness.